Hi, this is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. Our producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. You know the drill. We are recording our Friday show on Thursday morning. So normally we hang out with some folks from Texas, but we were not able to arrange that today. But I do want to start the show with a story about Texas and Harris County. And of course, the man that I almost despise as much as I despise Donald Trump, the Attorney General of Texas, Ken Paxton. You will hear why. The story is the Texas Supreme Court blocks Harris County from sending guaranteed income payments. The Texas Supreme Court issued an emergency stay of Harris County's guaranteed income program Tuesday, blocking the county from issuing any payments pending further action from the court. The stay came shortly after Harris County officials said they would begin issuing payments immediately, one day before they originally were scheduled to be admitted. The public health director had her finger on the button, so to speak. But before the funds began transferring, the Supreme Court made its ruling. Harris County Judge Lena Hidalgo said during a Tuesday press conference, the High Court ruling was in response to a request from my least favorite person on the planet, Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, for an emergency writ of mandamus to block Harris County's new guaranteed income program by the end of the day. Two lower courts in Houston already had denied Paxton's attempts to block the program, Uplift Harris, in recent days. In a statement, Harris County Attorney Christian Menefee said the court's decision was, quote, disappointing, but not surprising, given how politicized we've seen the Texas Supreme Court has become. It's unfortunate that the court would take such an extraordinary step to block a program that would help people in Harris County, even temporarily, Menefee wrote. The court knew that the first payments were scheduled to go out tomorrow. I will keep fighting to protect this program, and I look forward to continuing to argue that Uplift Harris is good legally and morally. Payments for the program initially were scheduled to go out on Wednesday. The Texas Supreme Court's action immediately quashed that. Quote, without regard to the merits, listen to this, the court grants an administrative stay as follows. Real parties in interest and their agents are prohibited from making payments under the Uplift Harris program pending further order of this court, the court said in its order. The stay is expected to last at least a week. Paxton's emergency motion to the state's highest court was aimed at blocking Harris County from distributing the first attached $500 per month stipends to more than 1,900 low-income residents. Paxton contends the program violates the Texas Constitution, prohibiting on giving, quote, public money or thing of value in aid of or to any individual whatsoever. That's really interesting. Thing to quote. Anyway, he also argues the county's use of a lottery violates the state's constitutional equal rights provision. So they used a lottery to give out the 1,900, because trust me, there are more than 1,900 low-income people in Harris County. Harris County officials earlier Tuesday said they intended to proceed with the program unless blocked. It's unfortunate. But here is the part that I thought was so fascinating. Menefee, who represents Harris County, expressed pessimism that the county would receive fair treatment from the Supreme Court, citing a Texas Tribune report about a recent speech by Justice John Devine, who argued Harris County bastardized election laws and suggested Democrats would cheat in coming elections. This, everyone, is a Supreme Court justice in Texas. At least one justice on the Texas Supreme Court has made clear he has no intention of giving Harris County a fair shake. And of course, part of the problem here is this is both a legal problem and a political problem. And of course, everything in Texas is a political problem. Let me welcome Governor Abbott. So I just thought it was so fascinating. We're talking about $500 a month. We're talking about only giving it out as a test case for 1,900 people. It, in fact, is being paid for, I think, by a federal American Rescue Plan Act. So it's coming from the feds. They're not even using state money. They're not even using Harris County money. They're using federal dollars to do this. The struggle is so great. And I just want to remind everyone that Texas has the greatest share of uninsured people in the United States, the highest percentage, and they're one of the few states that didn't expand Medicaid. So look at what they're doing. They're doing everything they can to put a finger on the scale to hurt struggling, working people. And now what does Ken Paxton do? He does this. And what does the Texas Supreme Court do? They genuflect to Ken Paxton, and they don't even give a reason why they're doing it. But at least it's for another week. But I agree with the attorney representing Harris County. I don't think the Texas Supreme Court will give Harris County a fair shake. Now, yesterday, we had the beginning of a fascinating interview with Elliot Haspel. He had a piece entitled "The End User is a Dollar Sign, It's Not a Child: How Private Equity and Shareholders Are Reshaping American Childcare." And I wanted to bring Elliot back, one, because we only got halfway through his tome. It was an incredible piece, Elliot, because Elliot is a nationally recognized child and family policy expert and commentator, and his specialty is early childhood and education issues. You go through so much in this article about what private equity means to childcare, to its affordability, to its availability, to its quality. And as I'm thinking about these 1,900 parents who are being denied their $500, these two stories really connect, Elliot. You know they do. Because, if we know that somehow private equity is going to make a profit on what tends to be a very unprofitable business, which is childcare, because it really shouldn't be in the business of making a profit. It should be in the business of protecting and helping and rearing children as their parents go to work and do it in a way that's affordable. You know that something is going to be missing from this conversation. And probably what's going to be missing when you say private equity and childcare is probably the quality of the child and their care. But I wanted people to hear this story in detail because, Elliot, you're not just telling a story of childcare. You're telling a story about emergency rooms. You're telling a story about nursing rooms. You're telling a story about hospice. Because what we're seeing is private equity is going into all into housing, into every area that is essential for life. And when they enter that arena, it's not because they are efficient, although that's their claim. It usually is because they figured out a way to extract a profit. And we know that if something is struggling to survive and be affordable, when you are extracting a profit, something has to be sacrificed. And the first thing that comes to mind is the quality of what it is that you, in fact, are doing. So let me welcome you back to the program, Mr. Haspel, and thank you so much for writing this piece, because there was so much in here. But let me just give people the table of contents to have them understand why what you did was such an incredible deep dive. You looked at profit from an unprofitable industry. That's how I started this conversation, an unprofitable industry. The changing nature of for-profit chains, maximized enrollment, minimized overhead, a captive customer base. Of course, if you want to go to work and you have a little tootie, what do? And now that we live in so much of nuclear families, you know this, Elliot, as well, and this wasn't part of your piece, but I keep thinking about how I was raised as a child. And this is how I was raised as a child. I grew up on Long Island. I grew up in a town called Hicksville. Guess where my grandparents lived? Across the street. Guess who took care of me so my mother could go to work literally within months after giving birth to me? And I'm 70, so we're talking 70 years ago, which is unusual. A lot of women were not in the workforce, but both my parents were in the workforce. My grandparents did. Who took care of me after school? My grandparents did. Who fed me lunch every day? My grandparents did. And as I think about that's because they lived across the street. And in many communities, your grandparents lived in the house, they lived across the street, they lived a couple blocks away, so they could help in the rearing of children. But you and I both know not only do we have the complication of the cost of childcare and the need for everyone to be in the workforce, but now we live in a world where when I raised my children, one set of grandparents lived in New Jersey, the other lived in New York, and I was raising my kid in a town of 1,000 people in Orford, New Hampshire. What did that mean? Who is going to help me care for my kids? I'll tell you who was going to help me. My paycheck. My paycheck. So anyway, profit from an unprofitable industry, when chains fail, economic power equals political power. Who is childcare for? Inconsistent outcomes. And of course, the most important thing, what the hell is the policy response? I put in what the hell. So Elliot, we got to profit from an unprofitable industry. I think we got to a significant portion of that. But the other thing that I thought was fascinating is you even describe when chains fail, because it turns out that when you connect private equity to whatever they're buying out, the likelihood of failure actually significantly increases. So welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah, I thought that was one of the most more interesting and I think alarming things I found when I was doing researching this piece is the systematic risks. And by systematic, I mean across the entire childcare system. When you have this corporate consolidation, and it's largely driven by debt. And so I tell two stories, which I'll tell very quickly for your listeners. One, there was a chain called ABC Learning. It was Australia-based. And in the mid-2000s, it was the largest provider of childcare in the world. It had thousands of centers in Australia and the US. It actually had bought the third largest US chain at the time in the UK, all over the place. But it bought almost all of these centers. It was acquiring through debt. And it was not doing a good job of fiscal transparency. And it actually turned out most of the sites were losing money, but they just kept growing, right? Just growing, growing, growing. And in 2008, when the global financial crisis hit, it went under. The chain failed. And the Australian government had to step in, $50 million bailout. There were parliamentary hearings. There were criminal trials. There was this huge scandal in Australia. In the US, it wasn't so bad, ironically, because it sold some of the chains to other private equity firms in the US to try to cover its debts before it went under. But it was a big problem. And then again, in 2014, the largest chain in the Netherlands, which is private equity backed by a US private equity firm, goes under. And so we have these examples. And when you are loading up these companies with debt, it really spikes the risk that if anything goes wrong, that chain might go under. And it's one thing when we see, I mean, as bad as it is, a company like Toys R Us, right, that's private equity backed, goes under. That's a toy store. When it
Right.
is childcare, that means basically the next day, hundreds, dozens to hundreds of programs are closing unless the government steps in. So there really is risk that as these companies and private equity companies use debt to finance their transactions, we're increasing the risk of something going horribly, horribly wrong.
So I want to just give a quote. As the researchers were evaluating what happened to ABC, the largest not Australian company that owned all these daycare centers around the world. And what the researchers concluded was this: listen, ABC Learning presented a classic clash of private interests and public need. Duh. I'm just like absolutely alien. And again, so I keep thinking about the daycares that have failed. There's been a small tiny daycare that had to close in my little tiny town. Well, that's one little daycare. When you're talking about the largest daycare owner in the world going under, you are talking about a tsunami of closings. Just please, everyone, think about this. I mean, again, my brother is a financier, and the one thing he and my father used to talk about all the time is you have to diversify your portfolio. Diversify your portfolio. Well, that's true with daycare. If one company is owning all the daycare, you're putting your eggs in one basket. And if they screw up, and this is a place where it would be pretty easy to screw up only because they tend not to be profitable, then guess what? You aren't just talking about, the little like 40 children daycare that's shutting down. You're talking about daycares everywhere shutting down. Think about what parents have to do. Think about what employers have to do. Think about how people are scrambling. Think about the people that are working there. I mean, it's catastrophic because it's not just about a child and the family. It has so many other ramifications that go so far beyond it to the community and to employers.
That's absolutely right. And so I think, that's where this calls for policymakers to get involved. There's a lot we don't know. And I was relying a lot on international evidence because we have better for financial reporting there. But with the exception of Bright Horizons, we talked about yesterday, which is publicly traded, and KinderCare, which thought it was going to do an IPO but then pulled back, none of these companies have to reveal almost any financial information. We don't know their financial position in
Right.
most cases. And so that's where, that's a very simple action policymakers could say, like, if you're going to have more than 10 sites, right? If you're going to be a big for-profit childcare chain, like, you need to tell us, like, how are you? Are you stable? Are you not stable? Like, what are
Right.
you, what kind of debt are you carrying? What kind of leverage do you have? Like, these are basic oversight mechanisms that the most states and the federal government do not currently utilize in childcare.
And they don't have a commitment to their product. I mean, and if their product is, they have a commitment to profit. So as soon as it becomes unprofitable, they figure out a way to bail. Okay. And I was telling you this story that we had this woman, I think she was with private equity, but she was in a variation on that theme where she was buying up or coming in to buy up the mills in the northern part of my state. Okay. And here's what she would say all the time. We're here to buy, strip, and flip. And she would say it that way. And the reason I'm saying it that way is she kind of looked like a stripper. I mean, that was like, it was more amazing was not only how she would present the argument, but then she packaged herself like she was a stripper. And I'm like, oh my God, and you're going to trust her? And you think this is the answer for your paper mills? We're seeing this sort of grotesque response here. But what's more frightening is that as soon as you see private equity going in, I want to go to your part three, because you're not talking about struggling little nonprofit daycares or even smaller operations that don't have a lot of political clout. You're talking about private equity that is not just involved in daycare, but they're probably like, they're like an octopus. They're involved in lots of other businesses, yes. Right? And so what you point out is in part three, economic power, equals political power. And that's the other thing that private equity has over everybody else. They don't just walk in and buy something. They also can buy the politician. They can also buy the lobbyist. They can also make huge political influence. And therefore, you may be complaining and parents may be complaining and the community may be complaining about the issues relating to daycare, but they can come in and they can cut a check. And you know how money and politics is such a huge influencer.
Absolutely. You know, and I would encourage everyone who's listening to read this book by Brendan Ballou, who's the former U.S. Special Counsel for Private Equity at the Department of Justice. It's called Plunder, Private Equity's Plan to Pillage America, and it will make you very, very angry. But, you know, he talks in there about how few Congress works harder for few constituencies than private equity, because they are able to write, you're right, they're huge campaign contributors. They're huge contributors to just like the lobbyists, and in many cases they're personal friends, they're hobnobbing with these folks. Like one of the private equity owners I think just bought the Baltimore Orioles, right? Like these are very wealthy, influential people. And so yes, we saw, you know, I cite in that article an example Ballou gives of how they spent something like $50+ million to fight successfully against an effort to curb surprise medical bills. You know, those ones where you just like, you get a bill for $20,000 because some one of your doctors was out of network. So we've seen, and when Build Back Better was going on, which had $400 billion for childcare and early learning, the lobbying group that backs most of these chains was actually working, the New York Times reported, behind the scenes against that bill, or really trying to help encourage, it seems like, allegedly, you know, Senator Manchin to oppose it. And so there's really a conflict of interest. And the more political power that the chains get, you're right, the harder it's going to be to win policies that lower the costs for families, that increase the wages for educators, that make sure that childcare is well accessible to everyone. All of that gets implicated the more that these chains gain political power. So you're right. It is a huge threat to the movement for better childcare.
But I'm kind of curious, because they didn't want this childcare provision put into the Build Back Better. But if they're so good at what they do, wouldn't they just have a way of more guaranteed income by having this childcare provision?
Well, here's that. That's a good question.
I mean, to me, it's like, well, do you really not want this, or do you want it because it's federal dollars? And federal dollars are like a guarantee income source.
It's because, it's how the policy is designed. So Build Back Better had a couple of provisions that you know, apparently, again, we're going off of some speculation here, seemed to be threatening to the business model. It said that you had to pay your workers a minimum of a living wage, right? And it said that you had to cap parent fees. So the government will give you some subsidies, but you can't charge parents past a certain level. And so, you know, I think I may have mentioned this last time, we've got Bright Horizons, for example, in their SEC filing saying, if all we get is more government money that is going directly to parents with no strings attached, I'm paraphrasing, that would be great for us. We could expand into new markets. They said, if there is government funded or government mandated childcare, that could pose a threat, as an existential threat, they're basically saying, to our business model by creating lower cost alternatives to our products. And that's the ball game right there. You know, it's they're more than happy to take public money if there are no strings attached. But if there are strings attached to lower the cost for parents and raise the wages for employees and threaten their profit margins, then they seem to care very, very much.
So what happened? Did the child care provision stay in the bill back better?
It did not. No.
It got pulled out.
got pulled out. It got pulled out.
Oh,
Man, when
Christ.
Mansion
Oh,
killed it,
God.
and then when they and then when they were negotiating what became the Inflation Reduction Act, the rest of it, which might, a few senators were pushing for a smaller child care investment there, but it got pulled out so that it ended up being
That
basically
has to be a
all
huge
climate.
story. No, Elliot, this is a huge story. This is a 60-minute story. This is a Rachel Maddow, where the heck are you? Everywhere I turn, the issue of child care is talked about. There was a story that was just done in the New Hampshire paper. They were asking young people, why aren't they staying in New Hampshire? And they said, what? We can't afford a place to live and we have no place to put our kids. I'm like, we're an aging population, the second oldest state in the nation. We're desperate for workers. We're desperate for families. They can't live here because they can't find a place to live and they can't find a place to do. Whenever you talk to almost anyone, and now I'm just going to throw this out here. You're going to hate me, Elliot, but let me talk about the Dobbs decision. So now we're going to be forced incubators to have babies, which means we have more children that we can't take care of with no place to go when we need to go to work. Like, can we connect the dots here? I'm just saying, Dobbs is going to mean that there are going to be fewer abortions, that there are going to be fewer ways of people being able to deal with these situations. And it's not just about children, it's going to be children that have so many compromises. And then what do? We drain the provisions out to provide more daycare, especially if we're trying to bring in remanufacturing and trying to bring in all these new manufacturing jobs, especially into the Rust Belt. How do I go to work if I have no place to put my kid? Oh my God,
No.
Elliot. I did not know this until I read your article, and I was so angry because nobody mentioned that. And I think that needs to be banged. That drum needs to be banged morning, noon, and night. That should be part of the November election, is what was in there and what was removed, because this is truly crucial for families, again, in light of what they're trying to do with Dobbs, which is make you be a forced incubator. It's outrageous. It's outrageous. All right, so we've got this idea. So you're part four. Is who is child care for? And I think, again, we have to understand there are many players in this conversation because it isn't just about the parent and the child.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And the question of what clientele, right? If more and more market share is going to these chains, then who these chains, private equity backed chains want to serve becomes very, very important. And in 2018, the Justice Department entered into settlement agreements with KinderCare and Learning Care Group, the two largest chains in the country, over American with Disability Act violations. Basically, there was a company-wide policy at Learning Care Group, which that's like Tutor Time, La Petite Academy, those sorts of brands underneath it, that they would not administer insulin to children with diabetes. That was a policy, and so and they had to have this settlement. We've talked about how many of these chains serve vanishingly few lower income families. So
Yes,
they really
yes.
want a rich clientele. So again, you sort of put this together. You're like, okay, so they want basically a clientele that is affluent and that doesn't pose particular problems, doesn't pose challenges because they don't have special needs, they don't have behavioral problems. They just kind of take the money and kind of coast through. And then I'm painting with a broad brush. This isn't every chain, but
Right, no, I
that
know.
seems to be the MO. That's a problem. That is a real question about fairness and access. If this is the model that where is becoming dominant in the country for childcare. So yeah, we do. And again, come back to this idea of policymakers have options. There are guardrails you can put up that say, here are requirements if you're taking public money. Massachusetts next door to you just did some of the most robust guardrails in the nation. They proposed them.
Yes. Well,
So
they
we
also have the
do have
highest childcare
options.
costs in the country too. I think the motivator was cost was making the people apoplectic, and suddenly Massachusetts had to deal with this issue and say, are we going to just sit back and watch, or are we going to do something like, i.e., the guardrails?
Yes, and then we're early enough. Like right now, today, private equity controls somewhere between 10 and 12% of the licensed childcare market. It is not completely dominant yet. Give this 5 years with no policy action, you're going to start seeing that spike, and it's going to be harder and harder and harder to extricate ourselves from that system, like we're seeing, as you've said, in many other places, many other industries. So now is the time for policymakers to hold hearings, look at what Massachusetts is doing, try to implement different policies so that we're going to limit the impact, limit the negative consequences of private equity inclusion in childcare, because we is just not We cannot combine toddlers and investors. In my mind, they do not go together. There's an inherent conflict of interest.
Absolutely. And I just want to read one more statistic because we only have a minute or two left. And that the Department of Health and Human Services found from using 2019 data was looking at turnover. Okay. Turnover, educator churn is what you call it. And they analyzed and they found 47% of analyzed sites having high turnover. 45% of independent for-profit programs had high turnover, while nonprofit and government programs were at 30%. So not only, I mean, it's like, again, they're pulling money out. They're not necessarily paying. They don't care about the child. But guess what? Even with all this, they have high turnover, and high turnover is so bad for kids' stability.
That's
The
right.
one thing you want to see is you want to see a constant in a kid's life, especially at that early age. One, it's important for the kid because important for the relationship. It's also important for the teacher because they know the kid. They know the kid, and that you have no idea. Having some understanding of that child means that when you deal with that child, because the child comes with a lot of backpack full of issues, you know how to be better, just a better guardian. It's the educator. All right, last but not least. You have inconsistent outcomes. So what do we know? Because I think what you sort of suggest here is that the research is very thin. Oh, I can't even ask that question. I'm done. All right,
You're
Elliot.
done.
This is like awful. We're going to get you back for number three. I'm sorry. This,
Okay.
I want people to hear this. This is terribly important. And I want them to know what Manchin did and that they pulled the childcare provisions out of the Build Back Better. It is outrageous. Elliot Haspel has written a fabulous piece. It needs to be reprinted in many ways, shapes, or forms in places other than where I'm reading it right now, because I think the story is way too important. And of course, the title is The End User is a Dollar Sign. It's Not a Child. How Private Equity and Shareholders Are Reshaping American Childcare. This, everyone, is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Can it be a crime to sleep in a city park at night when you have nowhere else to go? I'm Bill Newman, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute. And that question was recently argued at the Supreme Court in a case that arose in Grants Pass, Oregon, which has some 600 unhoused people, no public homeless shelter, and an ordinance that first fines and after that issues trespass orders with criminal penalties for sleeping in the park. At the high court, lawyers for those persons facing criminal sanctions argued that they would be punished unconstitutionally for their status of being unhoused. They rely on a 1962 Supreme Court case that held that while a state could punish a person for possession, use, or distribution of a drug, punishing a person solely for their status of being drug dependent is cruel and unusual punishment. Likewise, the status of not having housing, they say, cannot be a crime. Also, it's hard to wrap your mind around how criminalizing not having a place to sleep makes any sense. Of course, the point is not necessarily to make them go to jail. The point is to make them go somewhere, somewhere else. But, as Justice Sonia Sotomayor asked at oral argument, if every city, every village, every town passes a law identical to this, where are they supposed to sleep? A decision is expected by late June. The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU, because freedom can't protect itself.
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this. All the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place. And you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth. When you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth. When they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before. When Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news. When the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like
like 1933. When you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity. When you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells. When you see approaching the future this foretells. When they're coming for your neighbors. When they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away. When you know where they keep the buses. You've been to the parking lot. Perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
Welcome back to part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. And of course, you know the drill. Arnie records on Thursday morning. If it is Friday, it must be Bill Curry. Bill Curry is an American lawyer and politician. He's been a two-time Democratic nominee for the governorship of Connecticut, a White House advisor in the administration of Bill Clinton. He is the head of Freeze Voter, a nuclear freeze group. And I'm going to just stop and say, Bill, start writing again. I need to have Bill Curry in writing, not just talking, but in writing, because I want to be able to read you out loud to my audience as well. Welcome back to the program, Mr. Curry.
All right, I'll do it.
All right, thank you very much. That's all it took, right? Lauren Jadid is a freelance journalist who I read, who primarily focuses on the American conservative movement. Her bylines include The New Republic, Rolling Stone, and New York Magazine. Welcome back to the program, Laura.
It's always great to be here, Arnie.
So I saw a story, I believe it was at the American Prospect this morning, and I wasn't going to do it, but I was like, oh, I love this. And it's a quirky story because I know nobody else will be focusing on it. Because what? It looks at an election in Nebraska. Now, Nebraska is like a state that has like under 2 million people. They have a Republican senator who is up for re-election. And guess what? She doesn't even have a Democrat running against her. I mean, it's like, oh, my God, they completely ceded Nebraska to whatever Nebraska thinks they want. But they don't know because they're not given a choice. But that's not true. Laura, this is why I love this story. This is how it begins. This is my first time in Washington, Dan Osborne told me at a rooftop cocktail event earlier this month. He said, and as a statement of fact, but it's a humble brag for his outsider campaign for U.S. Senator in Nebraska. A union leader who organized the 2021 Kellogg strike, Osborne is a first-time candidate running as an independent. And with no Democrat in the race, he's the sole challenger to unseat two-term Republican Deb Fischer. Whether he's speaking to urban liberal crowds or MAGA voters in rural Nebraska, Osborne's staff argues that the message is the same. Politicians like Deb Fischer are stabbing working people like himself in the back. And he's running to bring the same militancy to Washington that he did to the picket line during the Kellogg strike. He's championing populist economic policies to curb concentrated corporate power. Yes. Rebuild the middle class. Yes. In particular, he's focused on railroads and big ag, old school monopolies that still have a stranglehold over Nebraska's economy. Now, this is the part that blew my mind. His advisor told me that the book Goliath, The 100-Year War Between Monopoly Power and Democracy by Matt Stoller, who we've had on a number of times, by the way, made a lasting impression on Osborne. So I'm going to start with you, Laura. I love Matt. I've learned so much from him. But I love it that this union organizer from Nebraska, who saw the consequences of this concentration of the monopoly power in his own state, in his own life, in his own health, and after reading this book and realizing what he was doing in his everyday job, that if anyone could carry that message, because he wasn't tainted by, you know, political influence or walking, trying to get up the pecking order, he was influenced by taking that voice and that knowledge to a place where rarely that voice is heard. I fell in love with him after reading this article, because it's why I want people to run. Because I think we need that diversity of voice and diversity of experience and reason for showing up in the halls of the U.S. Senate, because unfortunately it's the well-heeled, it's made up of the retired, it's made up of the rich, it's made up of the remunerated, but it isn't made up of people like Osborne.
In America, we have this whole ethos and this whole aesthetic of working class guy who bootstrapped his way up, Washington outsider. It's such a cliche that I think it's easy to really gloss over the fact that this guy is actually that and not just pretending to be that. This guy is somebody who made $48,000 last year. This is somebody whose hand was maimed in a factory accident. This is a guy who still works a blue collar job. This is not somebody pretending to be working class. This is an actual working class person running on a platform that I absolutely, it's ironic, Arnie, because the Republicans have basically painted everything that the Joe Biden Democrats are doing as communism, which weirdly leaves room for actual democratic socialist platforms to sneak back into discourse under a different label, because whatever he's advocating sure as heck isn't Joe Biden's party. It's beautiful. It reminds me a little bit of a story that I did a few months ago. I went to Detroit during the big auto worker strike, and I was seeing something very similar where MAGA Republicans and Bernie Democrats and just regular Democrats marching side by side in the name of these progressive policies, in the name of workers' rights, in the name of a decent wage and a decent life for middle-class workers, because that is a bipartisan position, and people aren't capturing that voting demographic, and people like this guy, I think we're going to see more of it. I hope we do.
Bill, you and I have both run for office. We know that he's raised around $600,000. He'll probably raise probably at least $1 million, if not more. But we know that the woman he's running against has a huge war chest. I mean, she's been in the Senate for two terms. That's 12 years. And part of the way that they keep people from running against them is they create war chests. That's the nature of the beast. You're always, always in fundraising mode, not because you're running, but because you want to intimidate the opposition. Okay? So she's got millions in her war chest, and he's got 600,000, at least as of this writing. But let me remind everyone, I think you will agree with me, Bill, when you're talking about a tiny state of Nebraska with 2 million people, at some point, a lot of money has no meaning, because there's like, you know, there's money saturation. And then at that point, the extra million, the extra 2 million, it's not going to change anything. And he is able to connect, I think, on so many levels where she cannot, that the amount of money that he needs is, it kind of reminds me of Jesse Ventura when he ran for governor in Minnesota. He just needed a certain critical mass of dollars, which he actually got through public dollars, and he won. And he won. And people were so shocked that he won. But it wasn't because he had the biggest war chest, but he had enough to be able to get the message out, and then the message connected. And I see this guy, Osborne, as having a real chance to connect on his message. And one of the things that was amazing was in the story, I think he's taking like NyQuil or some kind of something for his, because he's having difficulty breathing, because in the work he was doing the week before, he wasn't wearing his mask and his lungs were compromised. I mean, this is what he's telling people in Washington. I don't have a cold. This is from my work. And I think that's also important. And these are the kinds of people we want to elevate. And these are the kinds of messages that, frankly, I don't care what party you're in, I'm with you.
The failure of the Democratic Party to speak consistently for the interests of working people and the disadvantaged, economically disadvantaged, over the last half century, drove many voters into the arms of fascists. In the last couple of years, including in Tennessee, including with the auto industry and Amazon and different places, it's possible we're seeing that same oversight on the part of the Democrats may be once again driving people into the arms of union. This is a phenomenon. I don't want to exaggerate how much of it I see or what the overall union population has been doing in terms of rising or falling in the last years. This is a very difficult struggle. Like every battle worth winning, it's a long shot. But there's a possibility here, only a real possibility if we amplify it and underscore it and commit to it.
Yes.
But there's a possibility here that we've also driven people into a direct consideration of their economic interests. And just as Laura said before, you know, people overlook that candidates as disparate as Ralph Nader, Pat Buchanan, and Ross Perot all routinely did best in the same voting districts, that their overlapping populist appeal and brought out a kind of voter who was very much up for grabs, but who we consistently ignored. In one of the articles you sent me, reprint from The Hill, the reporter referred to the Third Way as a left-leaning organization. And I thought, well, there you go. You know, I suppose Mitch McConnell's still the center. You know, if we take seriously that kind of thinking and reporting and has driven the Democrats into a center that they mistake for America's center, but it's really only Washington's center, and it's killing them. The last thing, going back to the fight between Rahm Emanuel and Howard Dean and many other quarters, I don't know what his chances are in Nebraska, but I know that the decision of the Democratic Party to do this electoral micro-targeting, where you only commit any resources to the people who are in the best positions, I think it cost us a Senate seat in Ohio, and not only a Senate seat in Ohio, but the presence of J.D. Vance in the Senate for 6 years. I think that race was winnable. Any race that ends up as close as that one did is, by definition, winnable. And so, one, to begin to look at the potential migration of voters to unions and to union politics, and secondly, to recommit the Democratic Party to contest every House district, every Senate seat, every election to the best of its ability.
And you're saying something interesting. You're referring it, you know, that we're now, unions have a much better sort of public perception. And you described it as union politics, which is now worker politics. It's not union politics, it's worker politics. And that's why I loved Osborne on every single level. In a lot of ways, this is so personal for me, because the reason I got involved in politics in a lot of ways was I heard Shirley Chisholm speak, and she was speaking to a group of poverty workers. And she was basically saying to us, if you see the system is failing the people that you work with, if you understand the struggle, if you understand the needs, if you understand the kinds of changes that need to happen, then you can't just work for them. You need to go into politics and change the politics and the policies. And it was like an invitation in. She said, you can do this job. I applaud you for what you're doing, but your voice is also needed in a different setting. So think about running for the city council. Think about running for the state house. And honest to God, there were 400 people in this room, and I felt like Shirley Chisholm was talking to Arnie. And that was the year I ran, Bill, because she was talking to Arnie, because I had this incredible sense of frustration. And I've always described myself as the radical middle. That's what I am. I'm the radical middle. And I just think that his story is so important, but I'm going to go sort of connect it to another piece, which was what's happening in Tennessee. Governor Bill Lee, the governor of Tennessee, and five other Southern GOP governors spoke out against the UAW's drive to organize the VW plant. What was the vote? It was 73% to unionize in a state that is so damn anti-union. What is just remarkable is they've had union drives before in that plant. I think they failed twice. Laura, but people are suddenly beginning to realize, if not you, who is going to speak out for you? And you can't do it one-on-one, and you have to do it collectively. And they've seen union drives be successful in other places. And it's becoming, I mean, courage is contagious. And I think what you're seeing is the part of courage on the part of workers. And if they can show that courage in workplace democracy, then we need to connect the dots to what actually happens in November, Laura.
This is a whole voting block of people who I think, I mean, I don't want, the term radicalized is so loaded, but I at least have been, just like you said, Arnie, they are seeing the consequences of the degradation of unions over the last many, many decades. People are struggling. Most people are really feeling the pinch right now. Anybody who's in a blue collar job is precarious. And this is the mother of invention. This is spurring some real changes. And it's a beautiful thing to see. It's when everything falls apart, which I think it's fair to say, at least on a national level, things are very much falling apart. It does create opportunities on local level and maybe someday on a national level for something different. People are willing to take chances they just wouldn't have 20 years ago when things were at least somewhat bearable.
Let's also understand Joe Biden is very supportive of what they're doing. The NLRB is very supportive of what they're doing. I mean, there may be a level of corporate toxicity out there, and they may be hiring all these, you know, union busters, but you also have an echo chamber in the White House. You have an echo chamber in the administration. You have an echo chamber with, you know, Buttigieg, whatever it is, that's really supporting this as well. So the timing couldn't be better when I think you're seeing the grotesque inequality. You've seen the creation of all these new billionaires at what cost? They use the money for stock buybacks, not to invest in them. So in a lot of ways, there's this cacophony out there, but it's all moving in one direction. And the direction is workers, now is your time, and you better use it. And I pray to God that they do. But as we're looking at this worker issue, we're seeing another problem. And that is, and I put this down on my Facebook page the other day, Speaker Johnson was a primary architect behind the January 6th insurrection. Now he travels to Columbia to demand end of protests on campus. And I just think that there's a bit of an irony here that, you know, all of a sudden he's noticing all the riffraff and it's disastrous and it's unconscionable and he's using all these terms. And yet he is one of the really prime architects of what happened on January 6th. And I was just watching something on Morning Joe, which I'm beginning to really hate. But anyway, it was an interview with this reporter who had this long-term sort of conversation with Speaker Johnson. The accidental speaker is what it was called, Bill. But one of the things that was sort of concerning to me was here she was praising him, and he's sort of rising to the moment, and he's learning on the job. And it turns out that he's willing to sort of talk to people on the other side. But when she brought back what he did on January 6th and about the election and the insurrection, on that, he was not responsive, Bill. He was like, he danced around that issue. And in the end, all these other things to me, to some extent, have less meaning if in the end, he's still willing to repeat this idea that we should have a fascist in chief. And that to me is where I think his heart and soul is. Everything else is nice, but if he doesn't believe in democracy, nothing else works.
It was interesting watching Johnson sail up to Columbia University.
Yes.
To feel the vibe. You know, it's such an interesting situation. I'm still wrapping my mind around the president, Shafiq. I don't know if I'm saying her name correctly.
Right.
An Egyptian American. Mm-hmm. Who is therefore vulnerable to pressures on the Gaza issue, and no doubt feels that way in her position. Apparently some great radical. She's a member of the House of Lords. She's also a UK citizen. And so two big positions are president of Colombia and member of the House of Lords. So this would be the first Marxist revolution led by a member of the House of Lords. Just in case you thought there was any question about her establishment centrism. Like all the other presidents, she totally whiffed her appearance before the budding fascist Elise Stefanik in that committee. The others did so by being so overcoached and formulaic and not knowing how to just turn around the tables and say, let me be clear, you're all supporting a guy who has Nazis to dinner at Mar-a-Lago.
Thank
and
you.
Trades on the support of
Thank
racist,
you.
Fascist grassroots organizations. But you think anti-Semitism is coming from Harvard, okay? That's not Mar-a-Lago, Harvard. It would have stopped the hearing if they just had the courage and presence of mind engagement to say something unscripted. But like almost all of our Democratic candidates, they're so overcoached and they're so afraid and they're so overpolled that they just sat there like automatons and got mowed down. So Shafiq saw this and decided she was going to go in and be a total lickspittle instead. And that she was going to do whatever they wanted so that no one would fire her sorry butt out of that job. And so she went in and just agreed with everything they said for as long as she was there and left. And when she got back, thought she'd prove to them that she meant it by having mass arrests of peaceful protesters, including enrolled students. Mm-hmm. And Johnson goes up there, to go back to the image about Johnson, he goes up there. Why? Obviously, no question, to fan the flames. And in calling for the most extreme measures to be taken against these protesters, he knows, should know, anyone would know, that he's inflaming protests in 100 more campuses.
Right.
It is just fanning the flames of conflict in order for him to score a couple of symbolic points with the base. He's just somewhat ticked off by sending arms abroad. There's so many ironies here.
This is like a Republican wet dream. They now have, in some ways, their cover. So they just sent more money to Ukraine, more money to Israel, more money to the Asian nations. And they're doing this. And then you've got Speaker Johnson going down. This is the vulnerable place for Joe Biden. Joe Biden is vulnerable with young voters. Joe Biden is vulnerable about the issue about Gaza. Think about all these things where he is vulnerable. And now, in a lot of ways, they're celebrating the instability on campus. And what I thought was fascinating was the article, a Columbia faculty committee has condemned external media outlets for their reckless conflation of students' protected free speech with the abusive acts of non-affiliates. And again, so, you know, so this is, this is an opportunity for outside interests to make this even more toxic, because it's no longer about free speech. They want it to be a situation where it is abusive. They want it to be a situation where it is unstable. That is their goal, not speech, not concern. And yet that is exactly feeding into exactly what the Republican agenda is, you know, and they're hiding behind this anti-Semitism crap. And you and I both know your answer that should have been given to Congress was the best answer, because it would have brought people back to reality, which, Laura, frankly, they have no memory. All the anti-Semitism is on the part of liberal Democrats. The Republicans now have washed their hands of it like Pontius Pilate.
It's incredible. It's infuriating. It's their favorite little trick of turning around. It's the rubber glue thing. They just love to turn around everything that you say about them and then just make it meaningless by applying it to things that are absurd. What you and Bill Curry just said, I mean, this thing where, yeah, Mike Johnson is absolutely deliberately fanning the flames. And it's a great strategy, because we have transformed a discussion of the United States' role in what could possibly be termed, I believe, as an ethnic cleansing into a culture war issue. And I don't care what side you'd land on. You may disagree with my people who are listening may disagree with what I think about this being ethnic cleansing. Maybe you don't think so. The point, though, is that it is a much more important discussion to have about whether the United States is aiding and abetting a war crimes or not. We need to have that discussion. But that is a hard discussion, and it does not slot neatly into American discourse that we're used to. Everything that happens in this country, we have to transform into an issue we've done before. And what have the Republicans done? And what have, frankly, a lot of the liberal Zionists have done is transform that discussion into a free speech on college campus debate. It's brilliant. Now we can all have that discussion. We all know where we stand on that. We don't have to look at any of the big, hard issues. We can just rehash the same thing we've been doing since 2017. It's extremely frustrating.
So Bill, as comment, and then I will sort of respond to Laura.
Yeah, first of all, Laura's great.
She is great. I know,
and I agree with I adopt all of her remarks as my own, and I just want to say, she just mentioned the free speech thing, and it's so horrible. You know, the right wing has found a way in that, you know, rubber your glue strategy that they. The one thing Trump really taught them well, the Republicans weren't as good at this before Trump, but they're really good at it now. Most of them are. And, you know, that free speech was involved with the big with the big tech companies. And I have a million problems with big tech companies. But the free speech issues were entirely around two things. One, in each case, whether you're lying. In the first case, about a pandemic that was taking the lives of a million Americans, right, and 7 million people around the world. And secondly, about a subversive attempt to end the American experiment in democracy. Right. And if you were lying about those two vital issues, they started to curb it. And the Republicans, whose entire agenda is based on lies and who lie every day now for a living and a hobby and a personal life, it's what they do. They had to come out in that way. And it, just as Laura says, to come and turn and try to frame this as a free speech issue when you're quashing free speech.
Yes.
You're there to quash free speech in the name of free speech. And so, you know, this party of bigots and book burners is able to profile, go out and do this insidious performance art and get away with it. Because like the college presidents, not enough of us on the Democratics, from the center to the left out, call them out on it.
Exactly. So I've been thinking, I woke up in the middle of the night and I suddenly realized that Hamas and Trump are the same. And the reason I say that is this: Hamas got elected in 2006, and there hasn't been another election since 2006. If Donald Trump gets reelected in 2024, there may not be another election until he's dead. And the same kind of thing. So what we're doing is that whether you call it genocide, whether you call it starvation, whether you call it murder, I don't care what you call it, Laura. But what we know is that all these Palestinians are being sacrificed because it's in the best interest of Netanyahu and Hamas. not in their interest, not in the interest of stability, not in a two-state solution. And they have not had a chance to talk about their leadership because there hasn't been an election since 2006. That's exactly the goal of the fascists and Donald Trump and MAGA. They don't want to have an election. They don't want to trust an election. They don't want to believe in an outcome unless they win. And then if they win, you never have another election again. And we need to look at these things as the same. As the same. And so then what's happening is, so does that mean that we're going to kill all the Palestinians because of Hamas? Does that mean that now all Americans are now should be sacrificed because of Donald Trump? I don't think so. But look at these two. They're the same. They're the same. And nobody has made them no one has put an equal sign next to them.
This, this pattern of not wanting to hear from what I don't know, from voters not letting people. I don't really have anything to add, Arnie, except that. Yeah.
It's the end of the conversation. We need 2 hours. There's just too much to talk about. Laura, Janine, thank you so much. Bill Curry, thank you as always. If it's a Friday, it must be Bill Curry. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Wish you news on Monday, everyone. Ciao. You bet.